Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. With about a month left in office, the Trump administration has released a much-delayed 30-year shipbuilding plan that would build a fleet of some 450 manned and unmanned ships by 2045. It includes more submarines, but would consider stopping building Ford-class aircraft carriers after CVN-82, the fifth Ford-class ship, as the surface considers future carrier designs. A new beachable light amphibious warship to carry 75 Marines and their equipment, part of new Marine littoral regiments, would also be needed to supplement current amphibious warships. A second yard would start producing the Constellation-class heavy frigate that is now being designed and developed by Fincantieri Marinette Marine, our naval warfare sponsor, and to pay for a larger future fleet, the Navy is going to retire a number of cruisers, including ships that were recently modernized. Navy leaders maintain that they can achieve their vision based on current Trump administration plans that would increase defense spending top line to accommodate 2.1% inflation and another 2% increase overall annually, with increases to the Navy being even larger to fund a new fleet. 13% of the services budget would be devoted to shipbuilding. Navy officials also see their shipbuilding plans as part of a national civilian maritime renaissance. Joining us to discuss this plan and what it all means as a new Biden administration prepares to take office are our very own contributing editor, Chris Cavas, Brian McGrath of the Ferrybridge Consultancy, a retired United States Navy commander and former captain of the guided missile destroyer USS Bulkley, and our producer, Christopher Cervello, also a retired commander and former public affairs officer and the co-founder of the Provision Advisors PR firm. Gentlemen, welcome aboard.
Good to be here, Vago.
Great to be here.
Thanks, Vago.
And before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. And Beretta USA sponsors our land warfare coverage. Brian, you're a strategist. You did a stint in the Navy's strategy shop. You're a first order navalist. What do you think of this plan? Is it dead on arrival? And how and in what ways would it shape an incoming Biden administration's maritime strategy?
I think this is an excellent plan. I think it is a substantial improvement upon the fleet that we have today, and it represents some enlightened thinking about fleet architecture. And 3 years ago, I would have been cheering audibly for it, but coming as it does 5 weeks before the end of this administration, it strikes me as a naked political ploy aimed only at tying the hands of the next administration. And so it's a good plan late.
What are the elements of this plan that you like most?
First of all, I think attack submarines are among the most successful killing machines in our defense inventory. And building more attack submarines is a good thing. I like a larger number of smaller, more distributed surface vessels and a larger number of amphibious vessels. I like that, what that does for conventional deterrence, which is what I believe the Navy does the most of its time doing. And it does very little of its time actually killing other navies. So I think the plan does a really good job of balancing warfighting with conventional deterrence. And it looks to be at the cost of large surface combatant force structure. And it looks like one aircraft carrier. And I think those are trades that I am happy to make, given the overall fleet architecture. The problem, though, as we'll get into, I'm sure, is that this is late. And it doesn't have 2 years worth of administration support and 2 years worth of administration budgets and 2 years worth of administration resourcing. It is a political ploy designed to point back at by the Trump 24 campaign to say, look how strong we were and look how bad these Biden people are at achieving it.
This also assumes overly optimistic and overly rosy budgetary assessments, right? I mean, at this point, we're talking about flat and debating whether flat includes inflation, whereas they're counting 2.1% inflation and a 2.2% increase in top line. Cavas, what was your sense of this as somebody who has made it a profession to investigate the Navy's and probe and criticize when appropriate Navy 30-year shipbuilding plans?
For all the talk of a light carrier, this certainly is not a thought-out process. It's not reflected in here exactly what they think it is, why they're even looking at it. Sure that there's a justification for that in here, I'm not commenting on whether it's a good idea or not. I'm just saying I don't see it in here. They are relying on this LAWS, light amphibious warfare ship, to go a long way towards increasing the amphib inventory. They're looking at procuring something at least 35, looks like 35, if not more, of these things. It's not entirely clear what they're going to do and why they need so many. I think the requirement for the ships was only just signed out today. So this seems to be horse trying to catch up with the cart here, and I'm not sure what's going on there. The large surface combatant inventory drops. They are getting rid of half the cruisers in the inventory through fiscal 26, decommissioning 11 of 22. There's language in the current NDAA, the authorization bill that was passed overwhelmingly by Congress on a veto-proof number that restricts the Navy's ability to do that. There's no reconciliation on how that's going to happen. That's a lot of people. It's also a lot of money. The small surface combatant, they have a huge jump from 30, which essentially are LCSs today, to 66, maybe 67 frigates. They want to build lots of frigates, and they want to bring in a second yard. They want to bring that second yard in 2023, which seems incredibly optimistic. I would place a large substantial bet right now that'll never happen. They will not have any kind of mature design ready for production, ready to propagate to another shipyard that fast. NAVSEA is not going to function that fast. They're unable to do that. If they do it, good for them, but I don't think they'll ever do it.
And this is coming right as FinCantieri is working really, really hard to be able to put that facilitization investment right. I mean, last year, as I recall, you went up and you visited them and were first to sort of lay out what their strategic planning was going to be.
No, that is true. But then again, it has been assumed based on the rhetoric and the desire to build large numbers of these fast, this is a fertile ground for a second yard. How that manifests itself is to be seen. Not a bad idea. Simply, I think this plan is well overly optimistic. That's not going to happen. They will step on their own feet every which way from Sunday.
But for a second yard, I mean, wasn't the right time to have done that last year around the time of contract award, given that Richard Spencer wanted a second yard? Tom Modley, who was acting secretary, who succeeded Richard, also wanted to do that. There was a lot of talk whether Bath Iron Works might be the right yard in order to do that. And there seemed to be general comfort level to try to do that. I mean, was that an opportunity missed not to have done this last year?
It was an opportunity missed, but I don't know that bus has left. They can still bring somebody in now. They can open up some bidding, and that's a question which will await the new administration and the new leadership in the Pentagon. Is that where they want to move out on? I think the submarine point that Brian made is totally true. They remain committed to building large numbers of submarines. They want to have up to 70. More than 70 submarines by the end of this fit-up, which, by the way, is 2051. So it's definitely a ways out there. But they want to do that. They are planning for a 12 ship multi-year procurement for Block 6 Virginia class. Right now they're in they just started Block 5, which is a bulk buy, not a design idea. But so they're committed to at least 12 more Virginias. In here, that's a good thing. Brian is absolutely right, and they are the number one killing machine out there. And if you want to counter a growing large Chinese Navy, the number one way to do that is not with really more surface ships; it is with more attack submarines.
Let's quickly go to you, Cervello. Get your sense on it before I go to Brian.
Yeah, I mean, just very quickly to build on what Brian and Chris said. I mean, I'm not surprised that the plan is well put together. These types of plans brief well when they come from the Navy. I mean, they tend to think of a lot of things and they tend to present them well. My question is how elastic is that plan? When and if the new administration changes their planning assumptions, does the plan hold together? Can it be changed in a way that doesn't require a complete shake of the etch-a-sketch and starting over? My second concern is that it counts on the money being there throughout. What happens if the money is not there throughout? What happens if it takes a while to build the consensus for that money? And what happens when the decision comes down to shipbuilding or readiness? Again, how elastic is the plan and how many changes can be made? finally, I would say that if I had to be critical, I wonder if this plan isn't detached from today's reality of the complications of shipbuilding, the complications of maintaining readiness, and the complications of maintaining the ships that we currently have. I have a t-shirt that says 313 that long since stopped fitting me because I got it 10 or 15 years ago. And we still haven't gotten to 313. I am just really skeptical that we'll ever get to 450. So I don't understand the value in putting out a big number that we probably will never get to. It doesn't seem like it makes sense. And it seems like it's a shell game that navalists and naval professionals continue to fall for.
You know, that reminds me of a conversation we were having last night when Dr. Robert O'Brien, the National Security Advisor, and Russ Vaught of OMB put their piece out in the Wall Street Journal saying the Navy stops taking on water. And we were going back and forth on fleet numbers, kind of going down memory lane. You know, you said 313, 308, 355, 500.
If you're a leader in the Navy today and you read tomorrow's news clippings, or you listen to this podcast and you see and hear about this plan, you're just going to wonder what planet the leadership is living on. I mean, there are ships that struggle for time at sea because they're so backed up in maintenance. There are ships that struggle to get parts, and these are new ships. They are barely meeting mission. And the leadership said that within the next 10 years, forget about out to 2045, within the next 10 years, we were going to grow to 355 ships, while at the same time getting rid of almost 50 ships. I kind of wonder what the reaction is going to be, not necessarily from the navalist community or from pundits, but what are sailors going to think about this plan? And what sort of impact is that going to have in the short term?
Davis?
There's not enough talk about consolidating what they have and making what they have work and be much more efficient. There's an awful lot of work. This is an old story. People would much rather buy shiny new toys than fix the ones that they have. But we've made an enormous national investment in the fleet that we have. It's going to take a long time to build the fleet that they want. And they need to pay better attention to what they're doing today. And get a lot more use out of it. They're not doing it. They just don't.
Brian, let me bring you into this at the end of the day. The White House was has not made any other formal announcement after that. Navy leaders did talk to reporters on background today to try to explain a little bit of this kind of planning. I know that you were very bipartisan as a navalist in advancing the Navy cause. What are you hearing from folks in the incoming Biden team about the direction they're likely to go? Because it was folks in the Obama administration who would generally make the case that, yes, it's important to grow the fleet, but it's also important to support the fleet we have. And sadly, the drive to increase the size of the Navy, and in part because of sequestration and the Budget Control Act, we saw all sorts of maintenance problems and high rates that then caused a readiness problem. At the end of the day, what direction do you think that they're going to be going in?
I will have to guess because I don't have any insight. I'm amazed at how little I know about the Biden Navy civilian team, who they are, what do they know, what's their background. I don't have a clue. And what's interesting is that none of the people that I talk to who I think might have a clue seem to know who those people are. So I don't have a good sense. I can't tell you where I think they'll go based on who those people are. I think where they'll go is to dramatically cut back on the aspirations of this plan. I think they will be more likely to look hard at investing in weapons and networks and sensors to try to get more out of the fleet that we already have. To the extent that they are willing to build a larger Navy, my hope is that they will look at this plan and say, what are the targeted investments we can make to help our shipyards get to where they need to be able to actually take this additional work on in the out years, 4 or 5 years from now, and make those investments preparing for a time where they can actually build at this rate that they're suggesting. But the fact that the 23 through 26 years of this plan are such a dramatic increase so fast, it strikes me as an element that injects risk into the plan, and money might be better spent on the things that connect the ships we have rather than more ships from a stretched industrial base already.
Kavis, what's your sense, right? I mean, you try to talk to people to sort of gauge what the new team is going to be looking at. Cervello, I'm going to ask you the same question. Do you have any sense on what direction the new administration is going to be going in?
Actually, I'd have to agree with Brian. No, I don't. We're not even sure exactly who the new defense secretary is going to be. What is their outlook going to be? We also don't know the makeup in Congress and who are the power sources going to be there. There's a lack of a good naval champion in the House. And I would say this is the same on the Senate side. And I don't know the answers to that right now. There are definitely some staffers behind the scenes who drive issues. But for the out front people, I don't know. I still miss Randy Forbes. I admit that. Actually, Randy Forbes, I wouldn't mind seeing as the Navy Secretary. If the Biden administration is looking for Republicans to put into places, I think when it comes to being a navalist, Randy Forbes was terribly well informed and relatively politically agnostic.
I think this is going to be a little bit rarer in this administration than most Democratic administrations, because there is a sense that does not necessarily get you that much at the end of the day. Chris, any sense from what you're picking up in terms of direction? And then I've got a maritime question I want to ask both of you guys as well.
If you take the administration on their word thus far, they are going to put a lot of effort into diplomacy, and the economic drivers of national security will be front and center. And the Navy normally does pretty well when that's the case. What does that mean in terms of ship numbers and budgets and weapons and things like that? I don't know. I mean, because it wasn't talked about at all during the campaign. But in terms of being in demand and being needed, if the Biden administration is going to place the emphasis on diplomacy and on treasury and trade, I think there's going to be an important role for the Navy that will require some plussing up.
This administration and part of this plan was explained to us as part of a national civilian maritime revival, right? We've seen the MARAD, retired Rear Admiral Mark Busby, very articulately make the case for why we need a bigger sea lift force. Brian, right? Mahan is alive and well, and everybody's thinking, right? The bigger our merchant fleet, the bigger our Navy, the more successful the nation will be. I think that puts the kind of cart before the horse in some respects. But at the end of the day, I mean, do you see any sort of national civilian expansion and the kind of resources that would be necessary to do that? I completely understand from a sea lift standpoint and how vulnerable our sea lines of communication will be. Admiral Busby has very articulately and appropriately, terrifyingly explained that, of the 80 some odd ships we have, we're likely to lose 50 of them in the first week of a conflict, because I think our adversaries know how vulnerable that force is. Just like a lot of these, it's the oilers and the replenishment ships that are going to be targeted, and even more so perhaps than the frontline fleet assets. What's your sense on what this broader maritime revival will be, what that looks like, and what that would entail?
It's a classic attempt to change the debate, right? The Republicans have been all over ship numbers and have raised, again, the size of the fleet as an important arbiter of our naval greatness. Those who don't like that as a measure of effectiveness point to the other elements of our maritime power and how we should count it all together and how we should invest more in some of the other elements of power. You get more bang for the buck potentially in some of those other elements. This debate kind of goes back and forth over the years. Bob Work, who I love like a much older brother, is a big fan of this whole national fleet, national maritime approach. I'm a little dubious about it, only because I think that there are certain things we need that aren't necessarily commercially useful, but that are militarily useful. And I think the military ought to be paying for those things. To the extent that there are commercially viable platforms that also help the military, I am all for those. In basic terms, though, we do need more sea lift to move heavy rolling stock, because I think we are going to be more of a continentally based army, and we're going to have to move stuff elsewhere. And that's going to happen by sea lift. And I think we need a considerably larger number of oilers, maybe not oilers as large as the ones we have, maybe station oilers and maybe hub and spoke kinds of things. We're going to need considerably more of those.
I will point out, though, that it's the current administration that's making that case, right, for a larger merchant marine maritime integrated investment. And the only reason I ask is we know that the Biden administration is going to look for a Buy American approach. And there's been a lot of discussion on the industrial base. How do we support that? How do we do economic revitalization of areas of the country that perhaps may have stagnated? So I was sort of interested, because it is a message we used to hear.
You make an excellent point, but I think the present administration is attempting to make a political point by pointing at a huge number of ships that they wish to build, and by in putting a sort of a national maritime focus on it, they're able to claim more skins. That's a political goal, and I wish them the best in it.
Brian, I know you've got to go. Thanks very much for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. Take care.
Kavis, your sense on the MARAD part of this and the implications, right? Because we did have a much larger merchant fleet. We decided as a nation we didn't want to subsidize it. It became, unlike every other nation in the world that had, has sophisticated commercial shipbuilding industries, there were a lot of subsidies to it. We stopped doing that. And now we build handfuls of commercial ships that satisfy Jones Act or go to the Military Sealift Command. I mean, at the end of the day, Chris, do you see any change in that vector? Right. I mean, these ships carry our weapons and support our forces. But then again, we also contract enormous amounts of civilian lift when we need to do that. I mean, how do you see this equation?
In this new plan, they are focusing. There's a fairly robust section on organic sea lift force structure, auxiliary force structure. This is good. Again, as with this entire plan, who knows how much of this is going to survive? Somebody else was talking early today and said this is a plan written in water. I'm not sure I would argue with that. So it's nice, but it does set down markers. It doesn't mean anything is happening, but if somebody doesn't want to do something, they're going to have to say, we don't want to do that. That, of course, is the political intent of this thing, and that's what Brian was talking about. On the other hand, there are elements in here which I think are worthwhile and worth putting down. So it's the fact that this plan exists, came out now on December 10th, is totally, completely, absolutely 1,000,000,000% political. It doesn't belong as a December document. It does raise issues and talks about plans that at some point people are definitely going to have to have a plan for to do this or to do something else. So that's not bad. One of the interesting elements of this is the Navy. Normally this plan, the history of this 30-year plan actually goes back to the early 20-aughts. And Democratic Chairman Ike Skelton, who at the time was the Armed Services Committee Chairman, asked for this 30-year plan just to have some idea of where the Navy's, where the military, the Pentagon is going. Just overall, what is your concept? Right. It was more of a notional thing. And as soon as they met that requirement, everybody loved this thing. It was great. Republicans, Democrats, military at least had to focus some of explain some of your long-range thinking. And it is built into thirds. It's a 30-year plan. Well, who knows what you're doing in 30 years? I guarantee none of us are exactly where we thought we'd be 30 years ago. But so you generally think of the first 10 years as realistic, somewhat realistic, or at least it's within view. The middle 10 is, well, you know, maybe we might get there if nothing serious changes. And the outer 10 years are really just notional. I mean, everybody knows that's going to change. So smart people don't ever take that last third terribly seriously. But at least it gives you some idea about where things might go. This, you know, this plan should have come out with the budget in February. Secretary Esper pulled it back he wanted all kinds of other elements to review it, which was kind of, because he wanted to make sure we had everything in here. Well, it's an annual requirement. It's an annual requirement because there's an understanding fundamental in it that it's going to change every year. We just want to know where you are right now. We expect it to change next year, which is why we want another report next year. So nobody ever said it has to be complete and have tons of input or input from everybody you can think of. That was a completely false argument. The Trump administration in their first submission essentially submitted the Obama budget. There was very little differences between what the Obamas put together and what the Trumps submitted. Almost none.
Cervello, what's your sense as we get ready to wrap up?
Well, I mean, I think both Brian and Chris did a good job of covering down on, you know, kind of the larger civilian maritime aspirations and repercussions. I guess I would say of everything that was rolled out, I'm probably the most skeptical of that coming to reality. I would say next, I'm most skeptical of the number. The Navy has been working on this force structure assessment, which informed the thinking on this 30-year shipbuilding plan. They've been working on it for two going on 3 years now. If when that 22 budget comes out from the Biden administration, we see something completely different, it will be disheartening. It will mean that all that work was for nothing. If there is a direct connection between that 22 budget and the thinking and the concepts and the work that went into the force structure assessment, and we see that the Navy and the Marine Corps have a rubric that can either expand up or expand down with the hub of strong integrated naval concepts, and really then what you're only talking about is how much you buy or how much you get rid of in each year, then I'll feel pretty good about the work that's been done. But what I worry about is that, again, that this all was political, that the work over the 2 to 3 years was for nothing, and then we'll find ourselves starting at a slow walk when we really need to be running at this point in order to stay ahead of the Chinese. The last thing I'll say is we talk about maintaining maritime superiority or extending our superiority. If that is really the goal, we need to get to work. Just like you said in your most recent notebook, we've got about a 2-year window across the Department of Defense. And I would say that, you know, given how long it takes to build and fund and get into the fleet naval assets as compared to other hardware, that clock is really ticking. And I hope Navy leadership hears it.
I'm somebody who, not to use that balance term, but there's balance. Air and naval power is going to be absolutely essential in the Pacific. It's not like if you build, you know, more ships and match the Chinese Navy ship for ship, right? I mean, at this point, they're already at 350 ships, right? So, I mean, now we're skating behind the puck, trying to get to some point of closest approach to them as they're on a vector that's a lot that's a lot higher. And you still need enormous amounts of air power, and you will still need ground power at the end of the day, right? I mean, so you have to do this in an integrated, balanced way on the amount of money you have, which is the reason why there are great hopes that everybody has that if General Austin becomes Secretary Austin, that he is going to be driving some form of transformation in the department, given that $740 billion, you know, if we peak and flatten at that, it's a relative net cut based on inflation every year. Gentlemen, thanks very much for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Vago.
Thank you, Vago.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.